Welcome to episode 377, the carbohydrate insulin hypothesis. Do you know about it? Well, you might without realizing it, because the entire intermittent fasting movement, the keto movement, and you could even say the carnivore movement, was built from this idea that sugar is terrifying and any spike in your insulin levels should be a sign that you're not healthy or you'll be fat forever. But guess what? Like all trends that have their day in the sun, it turns out that this wasn't totally correct. And so on this episode, we're going to be talking about the other important and useful functions of insulin that we absolutely need to stay alive, why you might plateau on your weight loss journey or why diets have stopped working for you, why nutritional satiation, aka feeling full after you eat, is the most important part of dealing with sugar cravings, and a lot more myth-busting and conversation around seasonal eating and the big bad wolf that is the sugar industry that create Bliss Point foods. There's heaps of great conversation in here, and I know that you're going to love it. So let's get into it.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Here we are on the Nutrition Wizards podcast. Not really. I'm just in the company of a nutrition wizard, which is good for me and good for you. Now, in 2024, it's my mission to coach 500 people to get control of their sugar cravings and sugar binges so they can stop yo-yo dieting, stop obsessing about food, and finally create a body that they feel confident being in. And if that rings a bell for you or resonates with you in any way, scroll to the show notes below, click some links, and let's have a chat. Now, back to the wizard who appeared on episode 167, 198, 206, 265, and now this one, we've got fellow Aussie Marty Kendall here on the podcast airwaves. Marty is an engineer who seeks to optimize nutrition using a data-driven approach. His interest in nutrition began 18 years ago in an effort to help his wife Monica gain better control of her type 1 diabetes, but since then has created an epic data-driven organization called Optimizing Nutrition, and has also developed Nutrient Optimizer and Data-Driven Fasting, which I know many of our listeners and many of my clients as well have actually done before. So, Marty, what's going on? Welcome back.
You're hilarious, dude. Great to be back. Have we talked that many times? I knew we were good friends, but that's crazy.
Yeah, I think this might be the most amount of time someone's been back on the podcast.
Oh, well, what an honor.
I know, right? People just keep listening, hoping to hear you again, basically.
The Marty and Maddie show.
Hey, that's got a good ring to it. And many people, whenever they send me a text message, since the day of predictive text, incorrectly,
they call you Maddie.
I get Marty. Marty all the time. All the time. And there's a part of me that goes, oh, I wish.
Oh, I'm blushing. Anyway, what's up, man? What are we going to talk about?
Oh, there's so much juicy stuff to talk about, especially with you ruffling some feathers of some big dogs in the industry with your wizardry.
Wizardry, yeah. I was just data, man. So anyway.
Well, let's start there. What is nutrition? Just data, apparently.
Yeah. I'm just fascinated by the idea that nutrition is about nutrients. And as an engineer, I want to quantify that and understand it, because I've just, you know, you mentioned my wife, Monica, but way before that, started out in a Seventh-day Adventist environment, and it's like the epicenter of nutritional dogma and belief. And then every nutritional movement I sort of touch and experience, you just see the same dogma and belief, whether it be ethics or religion or just, you know, everybody moves on from religion in their own little cult bubble named diet. And, you know, if you're not part of that club, you're not a true believer and you're wrong. And it's just like, surely, you know, we're such an adaptive species that survived in so many different environments. What are the key things? What are the quantifiable things that work for everybody all the time? What are the key factors? And that's what I'm obsessed with quantifying and understanding with the data.
I had a conversation with a friend recently who's got Sri Lankan Indian background. Yeah. And we were talking about this idea of variety in the diet. And she said, she was saying that's such a Western concept, because she's like, we grew up with the same curries and the same rice every meal, every day. And then I know people in like the Caribbean, rice and beans, you know, they've been doing that every meal, every day for so long. And then it's this sort of really modern Western idea that we need variety. Like, you know, and that I think plays into this idea of diet trends and diet ideology a little bit.
Or at the same time, we need to be able to get our fruit and our, you know, meat and everything all on the same day from anywhere all over the world. So it's, you know, winter here, but let's order fruit from wherever. And we've got this diet that is no longer influenced by the seasons. And it, like you mentioned, if you're in Sri Lanka or India or Thailand or, you know, Iceland, you'd have a completely different diet and it'd change with the seasons. And we were fine then.
Yeah.
Because you'd get more carbs in summer and more fat in winter, and it'd be this perfect cycle that you'd never have this magical combination of fat and carbs. But what the data shows is that we've engineered our way into a hyper-palatable, dopamine-overdriving, hyper-profitable dietary system that we just can't stop eating. And, you know, big food just goes, this is the formula. We hit the bliss point for every nutrient and they buy more and we make more money and then we can sell them drugs. And, you know, it's just this monetized system of food. And yeah, it wasn't like that 100 years ago.
Where do you think that ends? Because obviously societies end up so obese for so long.
Oh, dystopia, man.
At some point we all disintegrate into nothing.
Well, fertility's starting to drop. I was worried a few years ago that, you know, the food system we'd created was creating this population growth. And you look at back in the 50s, 60s when we started to inject fossil fuel fertilizers to create all this extra energy from refined grains and vegetable oils, seed oils in the food system, and that enabled this population explosion like never before. But now we've made ourselves so fat and metabolically unfit that we're becoming infertile. And, you know, we're also addicted to our phones and couldn't be asked getting off and talking to a real person of the opposite sex to have any chance of procreating. But, you know, I don't know. We always get philosophical and go down these deep rabbit holes, but you
I'm
know,
so
we'll
guilty
work
of
itself
that.
Out and we'll make ourselves so infertile before so long that, you know, that the human species won't be a threat anymore.
Yeah. Well, on the other side of that coin is whilst fertility is dropping, IVF is skyrocketing. You know, people that might have otherwise been able to procreate in a healthy body, you know, trying to get two unhealthy bodies together, nature generally sort of says it's probably a bad idea for the offspring.
Yeah. That nature's smart.
Believe it or not. So I'm curious to go down this satiety craving conversation. We talked about it a little bit before, and it's a big part of the message you've been sharing for a long time now. Let's maybe just introduce people to what that concept is, the craving versus satiety conversation.
Yeah, no, it's just something I've been fascinated even more by lately. And as I've dug into the data, I got, you know, a million days of data on macronutrients and 620,000 days on micronutrients. And I kept seeing this pattern. Like when you think of protein, we crave to get enough protein. If we're on a very low protein diet, we'll crave protein to get us to 12%, 12.5% protein. And then we try to chow down on more, you know, lean beef or chicken or whatever. And we just go, no, I'm just so full. And then that's, you know, there's always room for dessert. So you're going to go for the dessert. There'll always be room for it because you've tapped out your capacity for the protein. And now you want to balance it with energy from carbs and fat. And you see the same pattern with sodium and calcium and potassium. And carbs and fat have this magical little thing where they come together in the middle. It's not carbs, fat, carbs bad, fat bad. It's the combo of both that never happens in nature, that other than in autumn, that drives us wild and we keep on eating it. So
yeah,
it just sort of dawned on me that, you know, the data shows that we always gravitate back to this bliss point, this point of optimal concentration of each and every nutrient that aligns with maximum intake. And the solution is not to be malnourished by going under that, but to nudge ourselves a little bit over that concentration. So for protein, rather than 12% protein, go for 15, 20, 25, 30% protein. For sodium, for potassium, get a little bit more, a higher concentration in your diet, and you're well-nourished, you're satiated, and all that. For the food noise and the cravings that we're trying to shut off artificially with blockbuster expensive GLP-1 drugs these days, you know, it goes away. So,
and by GLP-1 drugs, you are referring to like the very popular Ozempic and things like that?
That's huge. And nobody's talking about the role that nutrients play in the food noise that everybody talks about. And really, that's the solution. If we all went back to foods that give us the nourishment, the nutrients we need, we probably wouldn't need them at all. Maybe some people who, you know, have gotten themselves into a lot of trouble need that, and a nutrient-dense, high-satiety diet is going to help them in that process. But what happens if you artificially turn off your cravings for 5, 10, 15, 20 years? How malnourished are you if you went from eating one large family pizza a day to a quarter of a large family pizza a day? What nutrients are you getting at that point? You know, I think that's scary. And, you know, I don't think anybody's looking at that because they don't want to know. But what happens to the, do we just become diabolically malnourished and all the longevity functions of our body just shut down because they're so dependent on all the micronutrients, the vitamins and minerals that come with real food?
I think from what you just said, an idea in what you just said that might not be super obvious to everybody, but this idea that cravings and appetite is connected to a nutritional requirement in the body. Mm. Is that correct? Am I picking that up?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, you need a certain amount of protein to maintain your muscle. If you don't get the protein, you're sarcopenic and you waste away. But you also need a certain amount of sodium and potassium and calcium and vitamin B2 and all these things, the numbers come together and it's just beautiful. And that's what I've been so excited about recently, is trying to work out, you know, how much of a factor is energy density versus protein versus potassium and calcium. And it's like the list of 12 different factors calibrated to get the perfect satiety score that is better than anything else that's ever been done. I mean, the University of Sydney did the satiety index back in 1995, and nobody's really touched the concept of satiety since then to quantify it. I think it's probably the most important thing of how we can nourish our bodies and crush our cravings by giving the body, our bodies, the nutrients they're actually craving. It's like, who knew?
But Marty, if you make people feel full, they won't buy food.
I know, right? And now Nestle is coming out with, you know, higher protein, nutrient dense, ready-made meals for people on Ozempic. And it's like, well, what if we just fed them that in the first place rather than this other crap?
Just get rid of the Ozempic and do the same thing.
Yeah. What if we just ate real food that, you know, meat, seafood, veggies, dairy, you know, you'd shut down your appetite and you'd be happy and you wouldn't have that food noise that we're all so addicted to food, apparently. But, you know, what are we addicted to? It's the donuts and croissants and all nuts, and it's those magic foods that are perfect, that only really occur in autumn, that prepare us for winter. But now we've just created a food system that gives it to us 24/7, 365.
What kind of foods appear in autumn, and why autumn, that have that kind of magical combination?
Yeah, I mean, I look at it from a circannual perspective that, you know, as I mentioned, summer's got more carbs, winter's got more protein and fat. Spring is more of a, you know, protein sparing modified fast protein and young fiber. And then autumn, you get this combination of fat and carbs with the nuts and the fruit and the, you know, you get the fatty meat at the same time. And, you know, you see a bear about to go into hibernation. There's something about the environment and the food in that environment that just enables them to gain so much fat so they can survive winter. And we're on the same program, but we've programmed our food system to tell us that winter's coming all the time, and we just keep on eating those foods because they're just so profitable.
I'm curious with this, the craving satiety idea.
Yep.
Is that even though those foods are available outside of autumn, if we hit satiety, should we not be, we shouldn't crave them, even irrelevant of their availability, right?
Yeah, if you get all the nutrients your body needs, your appetite switches off, you develop sensory-specific satiety. So even with sugar, if you add too much sugar to your tea, it's going to be like, oh, that's too sweet. I won't drink as much of that. Thank you very much. If you just, you know, sat in a corner with a bag of sugar or a bag of flour or, you know, 3 liters of canola oil, are you going to binge on that? You don't see the kids out the front of Kmart drinking gobs of, you know, binging on the canola oil, do you? They're not there with the pure flour or pure sugar. It's the combination of the fat and carbs together with artificial flavors, colorings, and even the fortified vitamins just seem to perfectly hit that bliss point for all the vitamins and iron. And if you didn't add those, I think our body would go, yeah, I don't like it. It's just not quite right. Thank you very much. I'll, you know, I might get some steak and chicken and seafood and salmon instead. But in like the cocoa bolts are fortified with iron and B12 and B2. And we just go, oh, that's just right. I'll keep on chowing down.
Yeah. You've probably seen this with people you've worked with too, but I've seen that when people go through an extended period of hitting satiation, getting the right nutrients, increasing their protein, managing their blood sugar, sometimes they go back to some of those foods because they want to, they miss the taste or they miss the experience. And they're like, Maddie, I don't even like the chocolate that I used to love. Like, what have you done to me?
What have you done to me? You've broken my appetite. Yeah. And they're no longer as seductive, you know, these. And that's the thing about the bliss point foods. Howie Moskowitz, back in the 1960s, genius quantitative analysis, developed, you know, a whole bunch of pastas and Dr. Pepper and all, using surveys to find the perfect amount of fat, salt, sugar that people wanted to keep eating. And, you know, that was 50 years ago, man. And the processed food industry is built on that technology, that every recipe that you see that's got a label in the center aisles of the supermarket is optimized to hit all those bliss points so you'll buy more. So anything with a barcode and a list of ingredients that contains, you know, refined flour, vegetable oils, flavors, colors, bit of sugar, whatever. It's probably not sugar anymore because they can flavor the fat. It's designed to hit your bliss point and it's not going to satisfy.
Do you think because of all this, you know, Frankenfood that's in our diet, do you think we've developed cravings that are like for things that are not reflective of what's in nature and that's part of the problem?
Yeah. Like the one big mind blow recently is like, as I said to you, we don't crave empty calories and we're satiated by really nutrient dense foods, and like the Big Mac and the pizza aren't nutrient poor, but they're not nutrient rich. They're right in the middle. They give us just the right amount of blend of nutrients and energy that aligns with maximum intake. So we want to keep coming back to that food. Like if you have a Big Mac or a Coke, it's tasty but not offensive. There's no overpowering flavors in the Big Mac. It's just like, yeah, it's okay. I can have another two. I'm not really satisfied, but it wasn't offensive. If it was too salty, or it's just got the right amount, the right blend of nutrients that keeps us coming back again and again and again. And the foods that hit more of the bliss points are the blockbuster. You know, you look at it, the Subway cookie ranks with a zero, and Trail Mix has got a zero satiety score, and the Big Mac has got a satiety score of four, and you know, the vegetarian pizza has got a satiety score of zero. And it's like, oh yeah, they're all the, you know, we measure economies with the price of Big Macs because they've sold, I don't know, 300 billion of them or some Macs. And McDonald's know what they're doing. They optimize exactly, you know, and your sweet chocolate isn't quite, you can't eat as much of that in the day as you can the pizza or the Big Mac. The Big Mac is sort of designed to be eaten all day, every day and nothing else. But the dessert, the ice cream, the sweet food sort of that we sort of feel addicted to, that gives us a bigger short-term dopamine hit, is sort of perfect once you've had your steak and veggies and go, I'll just round it out and get the rest of my energy from the dessert food. But yeah, it's those pizzas, the Big Mac, those sort of things that are perfectly balanced that we can eat all day, every day, forever, and maximize how much we'll buy and how much we'll eat and how much fat we'll store.
That's something sweet that people crave after the meal. Is that a habitual response because maybe they grew up with dessert or ice cream or whatever as kids and they're just used to that cycle of events biologically? Or is it the continued seeking of fulfillment from nutrition or satiation from nutrition?
I think we're just trying to balance the fat and carbs and protein and nutrients to get us to the bliss point, because there's a bliss point for sugar. You don't get addicted to apples or bananas. You get addicted to things that have sugar and fat together, and sugar's got a 19% bliss point. So if your food has 19% of the calories from sugar, it's the perfect amount to maximize energy intake. If it's zero sugar, you go, yeah, not that interested. I won't overeat your steak or your, you know, dairy, which has got low sugar. But if you've got fruit or really high sugar foods, you're not going to overeat those because you've filled up your glucose stores in your body. And you can think, hey, I've got 2,000 calories worth of glucose to fill a lot of fat, and I can only eat so much protein before my muscles tap out and I can't eat more. And my body says, hey, that protein's not a great fuel source. Can we stop with the protein and go back to filling up our glucose and fat stores? So you can think our body is always trying to solve that equation of balancing fat, carbs, and protein along with all the minerals and vitamins. So, yeah, I just think, and given the opportunity, we want to maximize storage for winter, because if those foods are around, winter must be coming.
Yeah, it seems like winter's always coming.
It never, it's like like Game of Thrones, winter's always coming, but it never actually comes. We never actually get to a point where there's no fat and carbs together and we have to go into a low-carb food environment. But then we get stuck in a low-carb camp and we never get out of that into, maybe we need to get our carbs down and go into the low-carb keto, but then we love the fat and we fall in love with the fat and never get into the protein spray modified fast spring, and we never dare venture to summer, which has got the high carbs and the lower fat. So, but whichever quadrant you're in, you're okay as long as you don't stay there forever. Eat seasonal, local, natural foods is probably a fairly good guideline.
Yeah, I mean, there's about four places I want to take this conversation, but while we're on the, because you've said low carb.
We have to do three more episodes, man.
Oh my God, it will be the Marty and Maddie show. But the low carb thing, like what are the consequences from a blood sugar standpoint or a diet standpoint or a satiety standpoint from staying long-term low carb and keeping your blood sugar low?
I'm a massive fan of low carb, lower carb. You get plenty of protein. And you know, you get out of that carb plus fat. The bliss point for carbs is about 50%, 48% carbs with the rest from fat and a bit of protein. So that's the maximum hyperpalatable formula that every processed food hits.
Yeah.
And if you get your carbs from 50% to 20%, you get a massive satiety boost. But that's also because you tend to increase your protein. I suppose then you get into, people go, well, it was the carbs and, you know, fat doesn't raise insulin at all. Therefore, fat good, protein raises insulin a bit. So we're going to avoid that and we're just going to go zero carb and leave fat as a free food and just keep on chowing down on that. And we can sweeten that and make fat bombs. And geez, these are tasty. And oh, my fat loss stalled. What the hell happened there? I turned off my pancreas.
Ah, so there's a plateau. There's a stunt.
Yeah,
stunted progression.
Yeah, especially when you believe that fat is a free food that you can eat in almost unlimited quantities, which, you know, if you're chasing ketones and believe the carb insulin hypothesis, then that's a natural conclusion for a lot of people because we just fall in love with food. We're addicted to, we use food for comfort and soothe our little stresses and get a dopamine boost and yeah.
Mum, mother, grandmother, nan, nana, and women with no kids. Have I got your attention? So I want you to imagine something. Go with me here. Imagine a life where even when you wake up tired and the kids are driving you mad and work sucks and things are problematic, that you're still in control of your food and you still make healthy choices without giving up and binging on chocolate and wine and saying, I'll try again tomorrow. It might be hard to imagine, but having freedom with your food is absolutely possible. And it starts by getting three things right. One, having a supportive community, building a strong connection with fellow emotional eating warriors. Two, having the right information delivered in the right way. And three, having a guide that can shine a light on the right path and have your back along the way. And that's me. Those three things are exactly what we've got for you inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group for people just like you wanting to end their emotional eating and feel good in their own skin again. And currently, it's free to join. The link is in the show notes below. If you've struggled with diets or felt powerless around food, you're not alone. But let me assure you, this is a community that understands your battles and is ready to empower you into action. So what can you expect on the inside? Well, we have posts and content that push you a little out of your comfort zone. We do Facebook Lives, have interactive Q&A session, and it's simply a safe space to face your food challenges and be honest without concern of being judged. If you decide to join us, I have a complimentary How to Turn Food into Self-Confidence ebook for you as well, completely free. The Healthy Mums Collective thrives on support, authenticity, and experience-based practices. It's a community, so the beautiful people in it is where the magic comes from. To join us and be a part of that magic, head to the show notes, click the link, breeze through a few quick questions, and you'll be in the Healthy Mums Collective before you know it. Again, the link is in the show notes below. I'll see you in the DMs or on the welcome post in just a few moments. I'm curious to go more into that idea of the plateau. Like what, because you know, that plagues so many people that try to lose weight, is that dreaded plateau. How soon is it going to come? How long am I stuck here?
What do I do?
So what's going on there?
People tend to increase their fat when they drop their carbs. So if you drop your carbs, good. You got out of that danger zone. But if you keep on dropping your carbs, you know, 20% is great. You're not going to get a lot of satiety benefit from going from 20 to zero. And once you go from 20 to zero, you're cutting out all vegetables, all low energy density foods, and maybe you're cutting back protein for some reason because you heard it was bad for longevity. Or, you know, we don't overeat protein. We can't overeat protein. Our body goes, nah, that can't do anything with that. So there's like a hard limit for protein. So if you dial up the protein percentage by dialing back your fat and carbs while prioritizing protein, that's the satiety magic. It's not only carbs, it's carbs and fat. And carbs is the short-term insulin glucose response, and fat, it gets stored on your body, and you need insulin to keep that energy from fat stored on your body. So the bigger you are, the more fat you have, the more insulin you need to hold that in storage. And what gets me angry is that a lot of people just focus on that short-term insulin response. They go, look, we studied the insulin response to food over 2 hours, and look, carbs has got the biggest insulin response. And that's because the body says, we've got no room to store all this carbohydrate, all this glucose in our body. Our muscles are full, our blood is full. So we're going to raise insulin to shut the release of energy from our body. So everything gets held back until we use up the excess sugar in our body, and then insulin drops. But what happens when you eat the fat? It just goes, the body goes, oh, cool, we've got heaps of storage for that in the back. Just, you know, rock on down. Back of the bus, and all that fat gets stored. And then the bigger you get, the more insulin resistant you get, the more insulin you need to hold all that extra energy in storage. And you never turn off your pancreas, regardless of how low your carbs are and how high your ketones are, because unless you're an uncontrolled type 1 diabetic who intentionally underdoses insulin, that's called diabulimia, it's really dangerous and you die. You're always going to have enough insulin to store the fat you eat on your body. If you didn't, that would be evolutionarily stupid.
And I'm of the belief nature doesn't make mistakes.
No, your pancreas is very smart and knows exactly how much insulin you need. If you got someone jabbing you in the bum with insulin, an insulin needle round the clock, your blood sugars are going to crash, you're going to get hungry, you're going to eat more. But the endogenous insulin that you're pancreas produces is the perfect amount for the amount of food you're eating. So the way to manipulate how much you're eating is to prioritize higher satiety foods, which are more nutritious, nutrient-dense foods.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of low carb as well, and a lot of the people I work with move in that direction. And I myself am very much mostly in that direction. But I'm wondering, do you see or do you know what happens when people get like carbohydrate resistant? Have you seen that? When people go extremely keto, extremely carnivore, extremely low carb, and then they have a carb and it basically wipes them out. Like they're just absolutely energy depleted. Like it's almost like their body has forgotten how to manage the blood sugar.
Yeah. Your pancreas is having a happy little rest in the back and going, yeah, I only need this much insulin. So there's not your pancreas isn't on go mode all the time. So once you have a big carb bolus, your pancreas goes, oh, wait, I have to wake up and remember how to produce all this insulin. So it just takes a while to adapt. And if you went back from a low-carb diet to a very high-carb diet, your pancreas would adapt after a few days.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you definitely feel like crap. A lot of people will see really bad blood sugars and go, look, I ate an apple and my blood sugars rose by whatever, and therefore the primary focus.
It's like the other side of the keto flu coin.
Yeah. But it's not the end of the world. But and people on a lower carb diet might see higher waking glucose, and that's sort of perfectly fine. As we mentioned before we started talking, low carb people tend to wake up with a higher waking glucose, and the glucose drops during the day, and vice versa for people on a low fat diet. The glucose in the morning will be lower, and they'll top up their glucose fuel tank during the day. So yeah, for people on a low carb diet, starting the day with a solid bolus of protein and then saving any carbs for later in the day is a smart idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Further to this conversation, I guess, on the low carb sugar insulin, and you mentioned before the, you know, the insulin sugar carb hypothesis. It's been a big thing, obviously, for the last sort of 10, 15, 20 years. And then intermittent fasting has sort of been the biggest social response to that, the movement of it, or the dietary response to that, and then add in keto and all of those other things. But they're all off the back of this insulin hypothesis, insulin sugar carb hypothesis. I'm curious, because you've ruffled some feathers in this world of famous people that sort of back this idea. What did they get wrong about the carb, insulin, sugar, blood sugar hypothesis?
A, they only consider the short-term impact of insulin due to carbs, which is higher over the first 2 hours. There's a longer-term insulin response to the food we eat due to fat and protein. So protein might be 5 to 7 hours, fat might be 8 to 12 hours. But to be honest, we haven't measured it other than people injecting insulin and tracking their CGMs. Type 1 diabetics see that they need insulin over the longer term for a high fat meal. And if you dial back fat, you need less insulin and your blood sugars drop earlier. And we see that all the time in the data-driven fasting challenges. But the second part of that, as I mentioned before, once you get more fat stored in your body, you need more insulin to hold that in storage. So they're only considering the bolus insulin in response to carbohydrates, not the longer term response to fat, which nobody's quantified. I wish somebody would. You just need a massive study with a whole bunch of type 1 diabetics tracking everything they eat. And I think that'd be great, because type 1 community really need that. And I've talked to a bunch of people lately after I got a bit angry about it and wrote an article, and they're going, yeah, we need this. We need to understand how much insulin we need to dose for protein and fat over the long term, because the current algorithms are crap and nobody's looking at it. And then nobody sees the basal insulin. And you might wake up with somebody who's on a low carb diet. 70 to 80% of their daily insulin is the basal insulin that they need, regardless of whether they eat or not. So my wife's...
Just to hold their body together, right?
Yeah. So they might wake up with a fasting insulin of 25. They're a bit obese, insulin resistant. They avoid all the carbs. They eat fat, and they've still got that fasting insulin of 25 across the whole day. So their pancreas is still working overtime.
Yeah.
And once you've dialed back the carbs in your diet, step two is to go, well, how do I dial back the fat in my body? And do I eat more fat or less fat? I don't know. If you're trying to get your ketones higher, which was the thing from 10 years ago, just eat more fat. It's a free food. If you've got your ketones high, your insulin will be low. But it just doesn't work that way. And a lot of people, like type 1s, I know, they chasing elevated ketones, they just needed more and more insulin. They got fatter and fatter, and they said it was like injecting water, and they needed 3 times as much insulin every day because gained so much fat because they became so insulin resistant. And once the fat cells fill up and reach capacity, you just need more and more insulin to hold that fat in storage. And what's the solution? It's like, well, stop eating quite so much fat. Get your protein without, you dial back the carbs, now dial back the fat.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so just making sense of it for myself. So it's like the idea that if you've got a lot of body fat, your basal insulin level will be high, because that insulin has not just the job of storing dietary sugar, but keeping the fat stores in storage and your whole body not falling apart. So that's the
totally
why that insulin is high to begin with.
Totally. So 80% of, for someone on a standard Western diet, it's sort of a 50-50 basal bolus split. Mm-hmm. But someone on a low carb diet, it's like a 20 bolus, 80% basal split. So the vast majority of their insulin that the pancreas is pumping out is just to hold the body together and, you know, some degree the insulin response to the fat in the food that we just don't measure because it's over a long period of time. So, yeah, the next step is to, you know, how do I increase satiety? And that reduces insulin. And the first macros masterclass we ran, the wife and I both did it, and her daily insulin went from like 35 units to 13 units a day.
Wow.
You know, she was on a maintenance low carb diet, then prioritized protein, dialed back the fat, and the daily insulin, you know, was a third. I was like, this is freaky.
Yeah.
I believe the data. Yeah, that's what I live. That's what I see every day. But most people don't have the luxury of seeing continuous closed loop insulin pump systems on the screen.
Yeah, it's the pinnacle of romance for most couples.
she's my Tamagotchi. Gotta keep my mission is to keep her alive.
That's such a funny comparison.
My 18-year-old son doesn't want to be a Tamagotchi quite as much.
But, yeah, fair enough.
But it didn't harm him. He set a world record deadlift
a year after
he got type 1 diabetes. So yeah, it just insulin, protein, get big, get strong.
Yeah.
Growth hormone and testosterone of a 17-year-old.
Oh, you must be so proud, like, you know, to run it.
And jealous, but proud, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, we all wish we were the man we used to be.
living vicariously through the 18-year-old son.
Oh, I was going to say, because you just said, like, you know, not many people get access to this level of data. And so the thing that I find is the biggest resistance to maybe an approach like this is the amount of tracking and the amount of data collection people have to do, and that they just get fed up with one making their dinner an algebra equation. And because that's just, you know, people enjoy food. They don't want to associate it with that. And they've been on so many calorie counting diets, they're like, data collection doesn't work. So my thing is, how do we make it practical for people so that they have to do less tracking and more eating and enjoying?
Prioritize protein and go low carb. But if you're not losing weight, and you want to lose weight, then, you know, look at, where is my fat coming from? Am I adding a truckload of dressings? And is everything I eat luxuriously high fat? Am I getting the highest fat bacon and the highest fat steak? And maybe I could dial that back. And instead of the full fat Greek yogurt, go for the high protein, low fat Greek yogurt, or low fat cottage cheese, or, you know, even egg whites with one whole egg just doesn't really taste any different. All those little hacks that tweak it. But it's amazing how many people in our programs have gone through keto and low carb and extended fasting, intermittent fasting and everything, especially the older females who, you know, when they hit menopause, it becomes quite dramatic due to the changes in hormones that they struggle to hold on to the muscle mass, and then the body senses that and says, we need more protein to keep our muscles, so we eat more. If we keep on eating the same low protein percentage stuff that we ate before, they just keep on gaining weight. So that bit of tracking at that point, we tend to attract the people who have tried everything else, and then they get into our programs and go, wow, I track my food and I can't believe how much fat I was eating and now I'm so full. We just take what they're currently eating and say, we're not trying to limit calories. We're trying to optimize your diet to increase satiety and increase nutrient density. We're not tracking to restrict. We're tracking so we can make sure we nourish our bodies and give them exactly what they need precisely. And then they go, oh, so much food. I can't eat at all. And I'm, you know, so few calories. I'm so full. And wow, look, I'm losing weight. This is the only thing that's ever worked.
Yeah. You said in there something which first person I've heard say in a long time. You said get the low-fat option, but isn't one of the problems in the supermarket that low-fat products have got sugar replacements?
Yeah, not the low-fat, high-protein Greek yogurt.
Okay.
You know, and that's where a bit of tracking to learn what your food actually contains. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
There was a big low-fat craze and the food manufacturers just went, we're going to, you know, protein is expensive, so we can't make it high-protein, so we're going to swap the fat for sugar and high-fructose corn syrup. And then Atkins came along and everybody tried to go low carb, and then artificial sweeteners got approved and went, oh, huzzah, we can no longer we no longer need to use high fructose corn syrup. We can sweeten the vegetable oils and, you know, we go again. And vegetable oils have just skyrocketed since then as this empty calorie input to our food system that's super cheap. We can flavor it to be anything we want and make a lot more money. And I think it's probably, in terms of dietary induced thermogenesis, the fat probably gets absorbed into our body even easier than the sugar and the high fructose corn syrup. It just, the body just goes, yeah, we got heaps of room for the fat. We don't even have to process it to turn it into fat through pergenesis.
Yeah. Curious, as you were talking about the manufacturers identifying protein as expensive, do you think that's a part of the whole fast food industry moving to plant-based burgers and stuff like that?
It's cheaper.
Cheaper. Money-saving, right?
It's cheaper. Cows and dairy are expensive, and that dairy needs to be refrigerated. But if you make an ice cream with fake foods and engineer it, you can ship it across the country. The ultra-processed people is a fascinating read. And also I've loved Michael Moss's Fat Sugar, Sugar, Fat, Salt, just tells the history of the processed food industry and how they took Howie Moskowitz's engineering technology to make, you know, Philip Morris bought General Foods and Kraft and just turned them into the same addictive foods that they, when they saw that the cigarettes were on the down and not going to make money there, so we're going to use the same, you know, addictive, I'm not sure I agree food is addictive, it's a debatable topic, but because we need to eat and it doesn't produce as much dopamine as cocaine. There's a little dopamine response, but that's a whole nother topic. But yeah, they've just optimized their food for profit. That's it. It's just money. It's not a conspiracy.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard a few. Is it Chris Van Tolkien?
Yeah. Ultra processed people. Good read.
Yeah. It's a great read. I need to get him on the podcast.
A lot of people loved it. It's been incredibly popular, especially in the UK.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I saw him on Diary of a CEO.
Yeah, that was great.
And I'm not sure where I fall in that conversation because he's gone totally away from personal empowerment and, you know, the system needs to change. But I feel like the system doesn't change unless we spend our dollars somewhere else. The only language they talk is economics, right? So it's like we need a bit of personal empowerment to put our money in the right place, to push the industry to whole real food.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I'm not fully on board with the processed food being the only demon, because we can create hyperpalatable fat carb combos. Grandmas have been doing it for Christmas for centuries, and we know how to buy nuts and seeds and cheese and all these things that if we combine them in just the right way, they give the same dopamine overdriving fat carb response. So I think the label of processed food is fraught with issues, and that's why I've been so passionate to quantify what are the quantifiable parameters in a food that align with overeating so we can have a better, like the satiety index. If you know, my dream would be that cigarette tax like thing on foods that were optimized for maximum profit, and that would subsidize foods that were you know, more natural, more nutritious, more locally grown, and that weren't going to overdrive their high satiety, high nutrient density.
Imagine if the tax was determined on the satiety index.
Yeah. Why do you think I've been trawling through 620,000 days of data in a spreadsheet in all different permutations trying to perfect this satiety score? I've been completely obsessed.
Yeah, now you've just got to convince the government.
Yeah, I don't know how I get there, but I'm just trying to educate the people that will listen and create a better blog and better articles. And my dream, I've been talking to Robin Homer and Simpson a little bit about publishing the nutrient leverage hypothesis, you know, 20 years later after the protein leverage hypothesis. And their data nerd, Alistair Senior, went through my analysis and went, yeah, found the same thing. You're on the right track and we should keep talking. So, you know, I've got a data-driven fasting paper in the works that should be published soon, and nutrient leverage hypothesis co-publish with Robin Hunter and Simpson. That would be, then I'd die happy. I'd just retire.
Yeah, quit. That's super impressive. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I mean, that's probably a good spot for us to say, where can everybody find you online? Like, where can we send everyone to get more of you?
Just Google Marty Kendall or Optimizing Nutrition. I've got a website, which I've been working hard to make it really simple. Google seems to be loving my food list. So I'm just been updating my high satiety foods lists of high satiety vegetables, meat, dairy. You can just dive in and go, this is popular foods. So check out the website. And we've got a community of nearly 11,000 people now, which is like creating my little sub cult of people who believe nutrition is about nutrients. Everybody else does it. But yeah, it's just a really great community away from the noise that's so prevalent out there. And rather than everybody just debating the minutia, they're encouraging each other and inspiring each other and sharing the results. And that's where we do our macros masterclass and micros masterclass and data-driven fasting, which, yeah, that's my life. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of all of your work. I read a lot of the stuff you send me. And yeah, like I see that as kind of my own database of like, where am I at in this world? What do I think? Let's ask Marty. This is what I think.
Marty's always got crazy ideas that are never the same as everybody else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel a bit similar in that way. But no, thanks for hanging out again. I appreciate it. I love all of our conversations and our back and forth link sharing, idea sharing and messenger from time to time. But
great, man.
Yeah, but to finish up, what is one piece of information you wish more people knew about in regards to health, wellness, all this stuff?
I'm still trying to start a rumor that nutrition is about nutrients.
Consider it successfully started.
Stupid idea, but yeah.
I might tell some people today. I might whisper to some people at the supermarket and see how many people call the cops.
Yeah, it's just crazy. You know, it seems to be about everything else, avoiding all the bad things in food and, you know, plants versus animals. And it just seems to be a massive distraction. Mm. Like somebody said, is like a, you know, carnivore, plant-based, low-carb, keto. Is it just a psyop from the processed food companies trying to distract us from them just cranking out hyper-palatable, for-profit, crap, nutrient-poor food?
Yeah, and then with every diet iteration, they can just rebrand the same thing according to the latest, you know, dietary template.
It's easy. They just keep adapting the bliss point formula to any dietary template to maximize profit. But if people started to focus on, does it contain the protein and the minerals and the nutrients I need, they'd be staffed.
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's do that. Empowered people. That'd be cool, eh?
Yes, that's what we're all about. How to not get sick and die with Maddie and Marty.
I accept the offer to join your podcast full time, Maddie. Thank
amazing,
you.
Amazing. Welcome to the team. All right, man. Thanks for hanging out. We'll catch up with you soon.
Thanks, dude.
See ya.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.